This is lecture number 18 by Robert Vinoy of Biblical Theological Seminary on the Major Prophets. Lecture number 18 deals and continues with his lectures on Isaiah. Lecture number 18. We just finished Isaiah chapter 53, verse 4. I'll read it again. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. We discussed the translation of that and more properly understood it as a reference to the healing ministry of Christ, not his atonement. Then, in spite of these healings, those who saw his miracles did not understand who he was, for we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted when he was crucified. Well, let's go on to verse 5 that gives the explanation. Here is the explanation of why he suffered, why he was stricken, why he was smitten. Quote, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. End quote. Verse 5 is the answer to the question of why this one was afflicted and why he suffered. It's in verse 5 that you have the description of the atonement. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24 refers back to this as the atoning work of Christ. So verse 5 represents the idea of substitutionary atonement, and you get four parallel statements of that idea included in this one verse. Let me repeat them. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. Those four parallel lines all represent the idea of substitutionary atonement. That flows into verse 6 then, and I read, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This is probably the most familiar verse of the passage where this idea of substitutionary atonement is continued, and it's made clear that the guilt of our iniquities were what were laid on Christ. We read again, the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So verses 5 and 6 teach the substitutionary atonement. Verse 7, and I quote, he was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before shearers are dumb, so he opened not his mouth. End quote. You have the similar idea as in the previous passage in chapter 50 of Isaiah, verse 6. When it says, I gave my back to the smiters, my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. It's voluntary, in submission. Here again is an indication that the one who is described in these verses is not the nation Israel. Now you get back to that issue of who is the servant. Is it Israel, or is it one distinguished from Israel, an individual? Clearly, this doesn't apply to Israel. That is, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before his shearers are dumb, and so he opened not his mouth. That statement contrasts with the involuntary sufferings of Israel in the exile. The previous chapters in Isaiah, you find the complaints of Israel that hardly fit in with silent submissiveness, as these statements are in this verse. Verse 8 speaks of the seeming hopelessness of his death. Quote, he was taken from prison and from judgment. Who shall declare his generations? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. End quote. The seeming hopelessness of his death is seen in the rhetorical question, who shall declare his generations? He died young. He had no descendants, no posterity. There were a small group of disciples that had been with him during the time of his ministry, but they all deserted him at the time of his death. And indeed, he was cut off from the land of the living. It seemed hopeless. He was taken from prison, from judgment. Who shall declare his generations? He's cut off out of the land of the living. Now, the New International Version says here, who can speak of his descendants? I think the point is, here's a person who's put to death and he doesn't have any descendants. It seems like it's really the end. Then we have the last phrase, the question is asked, why? Why did this happen? The last phrase answers with substitutionary atonement again. It's for the transgression of my people that he was stricken. So let's go on then to verse 9. Verse 9 in the King James, the first phrase reads, quote, "And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death," end quote. Now look at your citation page again, page 32. I've taken a couple more paragraphs from McCrae. He has a very interesting discussion of verse 9 that I think really helps understand or to bring out the point that's being made in verse 9 relating to the work of Christ. I'm quoting him. "The first half of verse 9 is a remarkable prediction of an unusual circumstance that would occur in connection with the crucifixion of Christ. Here's the translation of the King James Version, but it's somewhat inaccurate. When the words are precisely translated, their relation to what occurred at the death of Christ becomes much clearer. This is particularly true of the first clause. Here the King James Version reads, 'He made his grave.' That should be 'grave with the wicked.' However, the verb used is not ordinarily rendered as 'make.' Its most common translation is 'give' in the Hebrew. And in the Hebrew, that's the verb natan. It's a very common Hebrew word. Its most common translation is 'give.' It's often used for appointing or assigning. As rendered in the King James Version, it sounds as if the servant himself made his own grave. And so, the King James says, 'He made his grave with the wicked.' Actually, the phrase is impersonal. This is a usage common in many languages, but not usually expressed that way in English. Our idiom, however, to follow the Hebrew would be, 'They assigned his grave,' or 'his grave was assigned.' The word rendered 'the wicked' in 'He made his grave with the wicked,' the word rendered 'the wicked' in the King James Version is in the plural but has no article. That is, in the Hebrew, it is the plural but has no article. It's reshaim in the plural form. It's more accurate to translate this as wicked men and to render the whole clause as 'his grave was assigned with wicked men.'" You see the way that flows. Since Jesus was crucified between two thieves, it would naturally be expected that he would be buried with them. The Roman custom was either to leave malefactors unburied or to disgrace them by burying them with a group together in an unclean place. In the King James Version, the verse continues, quote, "and with the rich in his death," end quote. Well, the conjunction translated "and" frequently means "but" or "yet," and is often so translated in the King James Version. So the idea could be expressed by "and," but it is brought out more clearly if the word is translated "but." The word translated "the rich" in the King James Version is in the singular and has no article. It would be more accurately translated as "a rich man." It was a normal expectation that the body of Jesus would be buried with the wicked men who were crucified beside him. Yet his body, instead of being buried with them, was placed in a rich man's tomb. This is something that could not have occurred except as the result of an appeal by a rich man to Pontius Pilate. And for that we refer to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 27, verses 57 to 60. When the verse is precisely translated, it is easy to see that this prediction was exactly fulfilled in connection with the death of Christ. But you see it better translated as McCrae suggests, and here's his suggestion. "His grave was assigned with wicked men, but with the rich man in his death." Let me repeat that. "His grave was assigned with wicked men, but with the rich man in his death." That's an exact translation of the Hebrew. Now, McCrae continues in these next two paragraphs, and I'm quoting him. "Interpreters who desire to take Isaiah 53 as referring to something other than the sacrifice of Christ find a great stumbling block in the words 'rich man.' They say they make no sense in the context and suggest the substitution of some other word such as 'evildoers.' Yet all of the manuscripts agree in reading 'a rich man.' The reference in the plural is to malefactors with whom he was killed, and that's followed by the singular of the word for 'a rich man.' In the complete copy of Isaiah found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Hebrew word for 'a rich man' was first written in the plural and then the plural ending was erased. You can see that on the manuscript. In the Bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research, Professor Miller Burroughs of Yale, a great scholar on the Dead Sea Scrolls, pointed out how easily this could happen. The scribe evidently first wrote the word in the plural under the influence of the preceding plural for the word wicked men, and so he initially wrote rich men. But then the scribe noticed that the manuscript from which it was copied had rich man in the singular, not in the plural, and therefore he erased the plural form. Thus, the Dead Sea Scrolls provide additional evidence of the accuracy of the reading a rich man rather than evildoers. This may be called an inorganic prophecy. And there McCrae ends his quote. Now, McCrae talks about, quote, an inorganic prophecy, end quote. Now, what he means by that is this. A, quote, organic prophecy is one that predicts how God will accomplish his great purposes. And inorganic prophecy is the prediction of an incidental feature that does not seem directly to further a divine objective, but merely serves as a proof that what occurs is actually the event that has been predicted. Burial in a rich man's tomb would not increase the accomplishment of the servant in burying the guilt of sinful humanity. It's an incidental point, and in itself it doesn't have any significance as far as the atoning work of Christ is concerned. It's an incidental point mentioned 700 years in advance, pointing to this particular execution as the one predicted in Isaiah 53. In the providence of God, the fact that Jesus was buried in a fine new tomb was a divine means for making available convincing evidence of his resurrection. For if his body had simply been cast into a felon's grave, the situation might have been quite different. The fact that the empty tomb is one of the great proofs of the resurrection, we see again that this incidental thing, that Christ was to be buried in a rich man, or with a rich man, is yet an amazing way in which this prophecy anticipates precisely what happened in connection with the death of Christ, and it's a significant confirmation of the fact that fulfillment is to be found in the death and burial of Christ. McCrae's observations made in connection with the first part of verse 9 are helpful in understanding both what is meant and how it relates to the New Testament. McCrae says, quote, as rendered in the King James, it sounds as if the servant himself made his grave. Actually, the phrase is impersonal. This is the usage found in many languages, but not usually expressed this way in English. Our idiom would be, they assigned his grave. In other words, in order to make good sense of the way in which that's used in English, you almost have to put it into a passive. His grave was assigned. Now, more important is the plural idea. It doesn't have an article in the Hebrew. So his grave was appointed with wicked men. His grave was appointed with wicked men by virtue of the fact that he was crucified with two other criminals. As far as the situation goes, you would expect that he would then be buried with these wicked men. We read, his grave was appointed with wicked men, but with the rich man in his death. It switches to the singular. You don't really have the article in either of these. Let's go on to the last part of the verse 9. The last phrase of verse 9 really goes more with verse 10 than it does with the first part of verse 9. The word translated because is the Hebrew word al, which really has the idea of concerning the fact or with regard to. So, concerning the fact that he had done no violence, the King James says there because, but it's better translated concerning the fact that he had done no violence, neither was any deceit found in his mouth, but it pleased the Lord to bruise him. Now, when you read, quote, it pleased the Lord to bruise him, end quote, I think the word pleased there is the word that speaks of God's purpose as foreordination. It was God's pleasure in that sense. This is what he had ordained before the foundation of the world. Salvation will be attained in this way. So we read, and I'm substituting but concerning the fact, we read, but concerning the fact that he had done nothing wrong, there was no violence, nor any deceit in his mouth. Nevertheless, it pleased the Lord, It was the Lord's purpose to bruise him. He had put him to grief. That word, grief, is the same word that occurs up in verse 4, where we read, "Surely he has borne our griefs." It's the idea of physical pain. He has put him to grief. He has put him to physical pain. You notice that phrase, "It pleased the Lord to bruise him," occurs at the end of the verse. And we read again, "When you have made his soul an offering for sin, he will see his seed, he will prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand." End quote. So you get that word pleasure again. God gave his son to die on the cross so that his purposes would be accomplished in his death. Quote, "The pleasure of the Lord," end quote, means in the sense of his purposes that they shall prosper in his hand. In English, the word pleasure is the idea that there is some sort of enjoyment going on. The emphasis is not that. It's the idea of eternal purposes of God, his good pleasure. In the middle of verse 10, there's an interesting translation question here. It doesn't affect greatly the meaning, but let's look at it. Let's compare the King James, the NIV, or the New International Version, the New American Standard, and the Berkeley versions. For example, the King James says, quote, "When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin," end quote. The NIV says, quote, "And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering," end quote. The New American Standard Bible says, quote, "If he would render himself as a guilt offering," end quote. And the Berkeley version says, quote, "When his soul shall constitute an offering for sin," end quote. In translation, that's where the differences arise for the most part. The question is, what is the subject? You have to insert it. You see, in the NIV, quote, "Though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering," end quote. So if it is second masculine singular, then you assume the Lord is the subject. The King James says, quote, "When thou," end quote, second masculine singular. The Lord, "when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin." The servant's life is an offering for sin. But if it is third feminine singular, and in Hebrew you can't distinguish the endings of a word to see whether it's second masculine or third feminine singular, they're identical. So it could equally be third feminine singular, and if it's third feminine singular, then the Hebrew word nephesh is the subject. See, like the Berkeley, it says, quote, "when his soul," end quote. Soul, by the way, is feminine in Hebrew. Nephesh, the word, is feminine. So if you take this verb as third feminine, then the nephesh, or soul, is the subject. So we read, "and when his soul shall constitute an offering for sin." The question is, you take the nephesh, soul, life, as subject, or do you take it as second masculine singular and have the Lord, thou the Lord, as the subject? I don't think the conclusion is a whole lot different. You still have substitutionary atonement clearly taught, however you render this. The second masculine singular view of the King James and the NIV is certainly possible, but here's the real question about that translation. This causes a change in subject from third to second person in context. You see, quote, "it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief," end quote. Are you going to change then from third to second person? If you take the third feminine singular imperfect, then you don't have that change in subject to second person. When you continue on as it has been, then we read, quote, "it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When his soul shall constitute an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, prolong his days, the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his name," end quote. So just an interesting question of ambiguity, really, that arises because of the verbal form as far as questioning what is the subject. I would prefer the "his soul" as being the subject, or "his life" being the subject, which brings up another interesting matter. Let's take a paragraph out of the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew lexicon under the Hebrew word asham, which means sin offering. The lexicon comments, and I'm quoting here, "This offering seems to have been confined to offenses against God or man that could be estimated and so covered by compensation. An ordinary trespass offering was a ram, together with restitution and a penalty of a fifth of its value." End quote. Well, and then I won't read all that, but notice the last line here, again in Brown Driver Briggs' Hebrew Lexicon, and I'm quoting, "The messianic servant offers himself as an asham, in compensation for the sins of the people, interposing for them as their substitute." That's Isaiah chapter 53, verse 10, end quote. And that's on page 31 of your subpage of your citations. The messianic servant offers himself as an asham, a sin offering. Notice the relation to Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11 as well. Leviticus 11:17 is a key verse in Leviticus. It says, and I quote, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood," and that's the word nephesh. The word life is nephesh. The life of the flesh is in the blood. I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, or for your lives. For it is the blood that makes an atonement for the soul. All this is from Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11. So the word nephesh, in the singular and in the plural, occurs three times in chapter 17 of Leviticus, verse 11. And here in Isaiah 53, you see it is the word nafsho, which in Hebrew means his life. His life shall constitute an asham, a sin offering. So the life of his servant constitutes a sin offering. That's, I would say, one of the clear statements of substitutionary atonement in the chapter. You have a number of them in the chapter, but that's a forceful one. His life, his nephesh, constitutes an asham, a sin offering. The next phrase is, quote, "He shall see his seed," end quote. That gives a statement about the results of the servant's sacrifice. Verse 8 said, quote, "He was cut off from the land of the living. Who shall declare his generations? He had no descendants," end quote. And here it is said that as a result of the offering that he shall make, he shall see his seed, or his posterity. He shall prolong his days. He will have posterity. His days seem to be cut off, but here it says he shall prolong his days. I think here you have a hint of the resurrection, that even though he, the servant, was put to death, he will live again. And so he shall see his seed. There will be a posterity. Now, of course, I think that what that is referring to is the redeemed people, those who were the beneficiaries from the work that the servant did, those who put their trust in the servant's work. Verse 11, and I quote, "He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquity," end quote. You can ask a question about that second phrase, quote, "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many," end quote. Is that the knowledge the servant possesses? That is, in the sense of by his knowledge? Or is it the knowledge about the servant that the others possess? In other words, it's the question of the objective versus the subjective genitive. I think most likely the his is to be taken as an objective genitive rather than a subjective genitive. So the phrase means, by the knowledge about him, that is, their knowledge of what he did, by that knowledge they have, the servant will declare many righteous. The last verse of Isaiah 53 is this, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide his spoil with the strong," end quote. Then you get several summary statements, quote, "Because he has poured out his soul unto death, he was numbered with the transgressors, he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors," end quote. I think that last phrase is quite clear. There is a repetition of ideas that have already been expressed in the chapter. The first part of the verse is one that's often caused difficulty in understanding. Here's what it says. "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong." Look at page 29 of your citations. I am inclined to read this the way Alexander, that great commentator, suggests in his commentary. Alexander says, and I'm quoting here, "It is better, therefore, to adopt the usual construction sanctioned by Calvin, Gazanius, and Ewald, which supposes him to be described as equal to the greatest conquerors," end quote. In other words, you have an idiom here in which the servant is pictured as a conqueror. I'm moving on. If this is not enough, or if the sense is frigid, as Martinini alleges, another commentator, by the way, it is not the fault of the interpreter, who has no right to strengthen the expressions of his author by means of forced constructions. End quote. Here's what Alexander suggests. Quote, the simple meaning of the first clause is that he shall be triumphant, not that others shall be sharers in his victory. End quote. You know, when it says he shall divide the spoil with the strong, the simple meaning is he shall be triumphant, not that others shall be sharers in his victory, but that he shall be as gloriously successful in his enterprise as other victors are in theirs. You often get a question of interpreters that try to take this in a more detailed, literal way. They ask, who is the strong that he is going to divide his spoils with? And you get into all kinds of discussions on that. Alexander sidesteps all that, saying, quote, the imagery used in the first clause of the verse 12 is simply that Christ is going to be successful and victorious in the work that he has been given to do, and the imagery that's used is that of a conquering leader or king. The simple idea is that he is triumphant. Well, Isaiah 53 is a great chapter. That brings us, as I mentioned, to the end of the servant passages. From this point on, you read of servants in the plural, but not again of the servant in the singular. Next, we'll look at the results of the servant's work. After the midterm, I'll probably spend one session on finishing Isaiah chapters 54, 55, and 56. That ends lecture number 18 by Robert Vannoy on the major prophets, particularly the prophet Isaiah.